Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. This week I'm going to explore one of the themes in my new book, How Football Began, and look at the rise of women's football in World War I. This continues on from episode 26's look at the troubled times of women and football in the Victorian era. Although there were occasional supports of women playing organised soccer before World War I, it wasn't until the second half of the war that the game became a mass participation sport for women. The war's rising demand for armaments created new work in engineering factories, and, especially after conscription for men was introduced in 1916, the government recruited women for what were once seen as exclusively male jobs, particularly making armaments or munitions in engineering factories. The work was physically arduous and exhausting, with a working week that could be as long as 65 hours. It was also unhealthy and dangerous. Women making bombs suffered serious skin and chest problems from the dust from explosives, and there was an ever-present risk that explosions could occur. In December 1916, 35 women were killed and dozens seriously injured when a workshop blew up in Leeds. Needless to say, absenteeism was rife, employee turnover high, and morale often very low. This meant that productivity was poor. To remedy this, many factory owners tried to improve the morale and productivity of their workers by providing welfare facilities, such as sports halls, playing fields, and even time off work for workers to take part in all kinds of sporting and recreational activity, of which soccer was one of the most popular. So, from 1916, a number of factories that were engaged in war work started women's football teams. Having been brought into heavy industry to do what was traditionally seen as men's jobs, the barriers to women playing what was also viewed as male sport were considerably lowered, and within the space of 18 months, dozens of women's soccer teams had been formed at munitions factories across Britain. Finally, the door had been opened and thousands of young working class women flooded enthusiastically into the new teams. Cup tournaments, international matches, particularly against teams from France where the women's sports movement had become very influential, and eventually local leagues sprang up in almost every industrial region of Britain. Women were at last playing a game they loved in large numbers. But their participation was strictly controlled. As far as is known, every club was coached and managed by men. Even the Dick Cairns team, where a woman called Grace Sibbett played a central role in its formation, was controlled by company manager Alfred Frankland. Moreover, almost every match was organised to support the war effort by raising funds for military or other patriotic charities. Women's soccer was framed as being another way in which women could support their menfolk, thus reinforcing traditional stereotypical roles and pacifying all but the most diehard opponents of women's sport. It's also noticeable that many factory soccer teams were set up in industrial towns in the north of England, such as Barrow, Wigan, Lee, St Helens, Huddersfield and Whitehaven, where rugby league was the dominant code of football, and the round ball game was widely regarded as unmasculine, underlined the way in which traditional stereotypes were not fundamentally threatened by women's football. The growth of the game should also be seen in the context of industrial relations during World War I. Many of the factories with women's football teams were also noted for the militancy of their workforce. In Glasgow, William Beardmore's engineering factories were pioneers in using welfare facilities to boost productivity. Beardmore's was also one of the most militant factories in an already militant city. Following a strike in March 1916, the chief shop steward, future MP David Kirkwood, was arrested and deported to England. The strike had been caused by management's refusal to allow him to speak to women workers in a section of the factory that made howitzer guns. Football was seen by the employers as a way of diffusing class tensions and making work in munitions factories seem much more attractive. The same point can be made about the Vickers engineering factories in Barrow and Sheffield, both of which had a reputation for militancy and also established well-known women's teams in the aftermath of strikes in 1916 and 1917. The same was also true in Australia, where women began to play Australian rules football for wartime charities at the same time as in Britain. The game there was encouraged by notoriously anti-trade union companies such as the Bone Brothers department stores and the Commonwealth Clothing Factory. From the perspective of the employers, it was hoped that women's football would be a patriotic antidote to rising levels of class conflict, especially after the Russian Revolution in October 1917. When the war ended, women's soccer seemed to be primed to become even more popular. Five-figure crowds were common at major charity matches, including a famous 53,000 crowd at Everton's Goodison Park on Boxing Day 1920, who watched Dick Kerr's defeat St Helens Ladies 4-0 to raise money for ex-servicemen's charities. This was not far short of the 59,964 who watched Everton's men's side take on West Bromwich Albion later that week. In a much more limited way during this period, women also played rugby union in Cardiff and Wellington in New Zealand, rugby league in New South Wales and Auckland, and Australian rules in Perth and Victoria. In September 1921, over 20,000 people watched the Metropolitan Blues and Sydney Reds women's rugby league sides play each other in Sydney. In France, a modified form of rugby called barrette became very popular amongst women and continued throughout the 1920s, while soccer also continued to be played in small pockets until World War II. However, women's football of whatever code was viewed by the footballing authorities as nothing more than a charitable fundraising exercise. Even the huge crowd for the Dick Kerr's match at Goodison Park got barely a single column inch report in the team's local newspaper. Despite the number of women's sides across the country, there was no attempt to set up a national league or cup competition. The government's post-war drive to remove women from the factories and reassert their roles as wives and mothers was reflected in football. Now that the war was over, soccer was once more seen as an exclusively male domain, unsuitable for women. All the so-called health arguments of the pre-war period re-emerged. A woman's delicate organism emphasises the danger of accident, strain and the ordinary risks of violent exertion, one doctor informed the press as an argument against women continuing to play football. Using the excuse of unauthorised broken time payments being made to women players, in October 1921, the Football Association's Governing Council warned men's clubs that they must have the FA's permission to host women's matches on their grounds. They also had to give a full financial report to the FA after each match. Shortly after that, Spurs were forced to apologise to the FA for allowing a women's match to be played at White Hart Lane without getting permission first from the FA, and Winchester City were censured for hosting Plymouth Ladies against Seton Ladies. The campaign against women's football reached its climax on the 5th of December 1921, when the Council of the Football Association passed a resolution that read, "Complaints having been made as to football being played by women, the Council feel impelled to express their strong opinion that the game of football is quite unsuitable for females and ought not to be encouraged. Complaints have also been made as to the conditions under which some of these matches have been arranged and played, and the appropriation of the receipts to other than charitable objects. The Council are further of the opinion that an excessive proportion of the receipts are absorbed in expenses and that an inadequate percentage is devoted to charitable objects. For these reasons, the Council requests that clubs belonging to the Association refuse to allow the use of their grounds for such matches." Initially, many women footballers felt that the ban on using FA-affiliated grounds would make little difference. The captain of the Strand Corner House team, a Miss Long, said, "The decision of the FA does not affect us very seriously unless our firm decides to ban the game." Alice Kell, the captain of Dick Kerr's, attacked the FA's insinuation of financial wrongdoing and defended the broken time payments that she and her teammates received. "It was absolutely impossible for working girls to afford to leave work to play matches. There was not the slightest reason why they should not be recompensed for loss of time." Less than a fortnight after the FA decision, 57 women's clubs met in Blackburn to form the English Ladies Football Association. In March 1922, the English Ladies FA Cup kicked off with 23 teams. But the men who led the new association, the president was Stokes Len Bridget, and only one of the five vice presidents was a woman, were businessmen who hoped to emulate the financial success of the women's game during the war. Yet without the legitimacy of patriotic fundraising, the women's game struggled to pay its way. Unable to succeed commercially and weighed down by the weight of male chauvinist scorn, the Ladies' Association lasted little more than a year, and mass participation in women's football withered. Dick Kerr's and a handful of other women's football teams continued as itinerant sides, and women played other football codes sporadically over the next few decades. But it would not be until the 1960s that, aided by workplace recreation facilities and inspired by the women's liberation movement, large numbers of women began to play the football code of their choice once again. And again, just as in World War I, the impetus came largely from working class women. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my name is @ColinsTony, and if you want to dig a bit deeper into the history of rugby and the other football codes, take a look at the Rugby Reloaded website at www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can also find a special Christmas discount offer for How Football Began, a global history of how the world's football codes were born. Until next week, thanks for listening.